Show 165, continuing Mark Curtis's Secret Affairs, British Collusion with Radical Islam. Last chapter mentioned the rift with Saudi Arabia and Osama bin Laden, things getting tangly as Iraq went into Kuwait. And this chapter is called Pakistan's Surge into Central Asia. In the early 1990s, it was not only Saudi Arabia that bolstered the rise of radical Islamist groups which emerged from the Afghanistan war. Neither did Pakistani covert operations end with the death of General Zia, who was killed in a mysterious plane crash in 1988, and the return of civilian governments in the form of Benazir Bhutto's Pakistan People's Party, 1988-90 and 93-96, and Nawaz Sharif's Muslim League, 90-93. Rather, Islamabad undertook a new wave of operations by using Pakistan, Afghan, and other Sunni jihadists to promote its foreign policy goals, both in Kashmir and across Central Asia, a big push, the consequences of which are still with us. Moreover, Britain armed and trained the Pakistani military at this time while deepening commercial relations. London not only turned a blind eye to the Pakistani push, but conducted covert activities of its own. Its eyes set on new oil and gas reserves in the Central Asia region. Just as Britain had sponsored Islamic radicals to destabilize the Soviet regime in the past, now Pakistan's backing of these forces was useful to Britain in countering communist governments that had emerged after the collapse of the Soviet Empire and to reduce Russian influence in the region. Islamabad's surge in Central Asia coincided with a new jihad in Bosnia from 1992, backed by Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, and Iran, as well as Britain and the U.S., as we shall see. These concurrent episodes constituted a second wave in the development of global terrorism after the first wave in Afghanistan the previous decade. And over again, actually got a second wind and a few chapters ahead. Again, the same thing about protecting the resources and trying to stop the spread of whatever it is, communism, democratic, popular, national, secular movements, governments. So the players change, the names change, but that same basic MO seems to continue, at least thus far through the book, and doesn't seem like it's changing with the modern news too much, except for the awareness about it, and some changes, perhaps. And this section, Kashmir and the British response, even after the Soviet withdrawal from Afghanistan in 1989, Muslim volunteers for jihad continued to flow into Pakistan and Afghanistan. Throughout the early 90s, Pakistan Intelligence Service, the ISI, trained around 20,000 militant volunteers at a special training school north of Peshawar, the city in northwest Pakistan near Afghanistan, which became the home of countless Afghan refugees after war broke out in 79 and was the Mujahideen's primary organizing center. And I mentioned John Major succeeding Thatcher's demise in 1990. London enhanced military and commercial relations with Islamabad. The essential reason was that Pakistan was viewed by the late 1980s as a significant market for British goods, including arms. Thatcher government signed a memorandum of understanding on arms exports with the Zia regime in 88, covering the period from June 88 to January 1993, the details of which were kept confidential. Selling of naval frigates for an undisclosed sum, etc., etc. And that section ends up with, by now, Pakistan military and intelligence community has its sights set on another target well beyond Kashmir, Central Asia. And get into the next section, very British coups. Well, here we go. By 1994, the military under Benazir Bhutto's government was training hundreds of Chechens, Uzbeks, and Tajiks at camps in Afghanistan, its techniques of guerrilla warfare, the aim being to export Islamist revolution in the region and reduce Russian influence. There is simply no British criticism of this Pakistani surge in the public record, in sharp contrast to regular condemnations of Ayatollah Rafsanjani Zarran, an official enemy, for its sponsorship of terrorism at this time. Islamabad's Islamist adventures were useful in hastening the breakup of the Soviet Union and countering its successors, both the communist governments that arose in the Commonwealth of independent states declared in 1991, and Russia itself. The main prize being fought over was the huge oil and gas reserves of the region, notably in the Caspian Basin and its surrounding countries of Azerbaijan, Turkmenistan, and Kazakhstan, which the British oil company BP later stated were on the scale of those in Britain's North Sea and thus of significant global interest. And I remember after 9/11, Gore Vidal was the first one I had heard about the Caspian Sea and that all the chaos could actually have something to do with oil and gas resources. Great Power Competition was a rerun of the 19th century Great Game and, from the British perspective, an extension of the Afghan War to counter Moscow's influence in the region. Islamist forces were, once again, useful as the shock troops to help secure the prize. Fascinating how Russia is still in that opposition position. And then it mentions later on, since Pakistan sending into combat in Chechnya, the ISI retained tactical control over these forces and helped turn what began in the early 90s as an anti-Soviet struggle for self-determination into an Islamic jihad. Azerbaijan, that's in Greg Palast's book, Vulture's Picnic. Alongside these operations by Britain's key ally, there was one country in which Britain placed a very direct destabilizing role alongside Islamist forces. Azerbaijan, a country which was emerging from Soviet control and possessed much of the Caspian region's untapped oil and gas resources. British policymakers set themselves the goal of getting a large slice of the cake in the early 90s in order to curry Azeri government favor and secure a massive oil deal. The British government helped funnel arms to the Azeris and promoted two coups to establish pro-Western business environment in the country. There you have it again, the militant fascism. From the evidence that has emerged, it was a group of Americans who began the covert operation in Azerbaijan just as the Soviet Republic was proclaiming its independence from the Soviet Union in late 1991. At this time, a U.S. company run by three career Air Force officers with CIA links and a past record of involvement in covert operations set up an office in the Azeri capital, Baku, B-A-K-U. The company called Mega Oil, the company called Mega Oil was approached by the Azeri government to recruit and train mercenaries to help fight its war in the disputed region of Nagorno-Karabakh in the western part of Azerbaijan. What was to become a two-year operation then began to recruit 2,000 Afghan jihadists and procure weapons for them. Many were recruited in Peshawar, Pakistan, by being offered $2,000 each. The weapons procurement program was to amount to some $20 million worth, while training was provided by retired U.S. Special Forces officers. Wow, that's wild. I'm just seeing on Axis of Logic website today, I had just seen a headline mentioning Nagorno-Karabakh, which I don't know that I've ever heard of. And here I am reading it. So I'm going to take a look at this article, see if it has any bearing on what's being said here. The participation of the Nagorno-Karabakh Republic in talks is crucial for resolving the regional conflict, Armenia's top diplomat Sputnik said. The resolution of the conflict is impossible without the participation of Nagorno-Karabakh. This is clearly understood, and this is what the mediators speak of. The Azerbaijani side simply pretends that it does not understand, hiding its head in the sand, but all working documents discussed in the recent years envisage direct participation of the Karabakh side. The Nagorno-Karabakh Republic, populated mostly by ethnic Armenians, proclaimed its independence from Azerbaijan in 1991 after the collapse of the Soviet Union. In 92 to 94, a military conflict with the self-proclaimed republic supported by Armenia, Azerbaijan lost control over the region. June 20, 2016, the presidents of Armenia, Azerbaijan, and Russia met in St. Petersburg, where they reaffirmed their commitment to achieve steady progress in political settlement of the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict and agreed to increase the number of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, OSCE, monitors working in the conflict zone. Yeah, that's what's next in a paragraph in the book about Armenian population declaring independence from predominantly Muslim Azerbaijan. It's sort of this form of transnational fascism when you've got other countries and peoples going in and doing stuff. Then eventually, this was not the only covert British involvement in Azerbaijan. A further aspect of the story centers on the coup in June 1993, which overthrew Abulfaz Elkabay, Azerbaijan's first non-communist leader, who had been elected with 60% of the vote in June 92. Elkabay was faced with a heavy military defeats in Nagorno-Karabakh, which, along with poor management of the economy, provoked a military rebellion to break out in mid-93. The June coup was led by a Moscow-backed warlord, following which a new president emerged in the person of Haydar Aliyev, a former KGB chief who had served in the Politburo in the Brezhnev era. On what turned out to be the eve of the coup, Prime Minister John Major told Parliament that there is no doubt that there were huge markets opening up in this part of the world, Azerbaijan, which I believe will be satisfactory for the UK, provided that we are prepared to take an interest in them at an early stage. And at the end of this section, throughout the 90s, further discussion took place on building a 1,700-kilometer-long new oil pipeline from Azerbaijan to the Turkish port of Ceyhan, C-E-Y-H-A-N. A consortium led by BP would manage the project, which was agreed by the end of the decade. By 2009, the pipeline was pumping over 700,000 barrels of oil a day. And you have, you know, discrepant information about the coup and arms, and BP denied any involvement, but said that Sother Oil Company representatives did discuss the supply of arms. In the last section of this chapter, aiding the Taliban, Pakistani sponsorship of Islamic militants went furthest in Afghanistan, where, beginning in 95, the ISI and Saudi intelligence funded and armed the Taliban movement. This backing enabled the Taliban to win a brutal civil war among Mujahideen factions that followed the collapse of the pro-Soviet government in 92 and eventually to take control of Kabul in 96. The first Taliban were mainly students of the Pakistani madrasas, notably those run by the JUI. General Pervez Musharraf later wrote in his autobiography that the Taliban were not a new post-Soviet phenomenon. They were taught by the same teachers in the same seminaries that had produced the Mujahideen. He added that we had hoped that the Taliban, driven by religious zeal based on true principles of Islam, would bring unity and peace to a devastated country. This was nonsense. The Taliban were the most extreme militants consciously forged by Pakistan simply as its proxy force in Afghanistan. The U.S. also supported the Taliban in its rise to power, seeing it as a counter to Iran and a force that would sign lucrative deals with the U.S. oil company Unocal, the story of which has been told by other analysts and needs no repetition here. A top-secret CIA report written once the Taliban gained power in Kabul in September 96 noted that the Taliban's leaders espouse a puritanical Islamic state and have imposed Islamic law, including punishments such as stoning and amputation, and rigidly enforced the seclusion of women. Yet, it concluded that there is no evidence that a Taliban government would be systematically unfriendly to U.S. interests, and that the belief of some Taliban officials that the U.S. was funneling assistance to them could provide openings for a dialogue on regional issues. At the same time, the U.S. State Department declared that it wanted to engage the new Taliban interim government at an early stage to demonstrate U.S. government willingness to deal with them as the new authorities in Kabul, seek information about their plans, programs, and policies, and express U.S. government views on areas of key concern to U.S. stability, human rights, narcotics, and terrorism. Although the U.S. provided no arms to the Taliban, it tacitly accepted its allies, Pakistan and Saudi Arabia, doing so. It was only after the Taliban had been in power for a year in late 97 that the U.S. started to break with it, probably due to domestic pressure on the Clinton administration over the Taliban's appalling treatment of women, its eventual refusal to support the Unocal project, and its harboring of bin Laden. At this point, the CIA stepped up covert support for anti-Taliban fighters, notably the Afghan commander Ahmed Shah Massoud. So again, shows how things turn on a dime and enemies become friends become enemies. And towards the end of this chapter, British and U.S. policy was to have catastrophic consequences. Not only did Pakistani and Saudi arms and money continue to flow to the Taliban, enabling it to conquer the north of the country in the autumn of 1998, but by now bin Laden was firmly ensconced in the country, having arrived in Jalalabad, eastern Afghanistan, from Sudan in May 1996, just in time to see the Taliban take Kabul. Bin Laden got on. Meanwhile, Bin Laden, let's see, the CIA suspected that Pakistan was providing funds or equipment to Bin Laden as part of the operating agreements at these camps. The U.S. intelligence reports ISI officers at the level of colonel met Bin Laden or his representatives in the autumn of 1998 to coordinate training camps. In Afghanistan, from militants destined for Kashmir, the CIA suspected that Pakistan was providing funds, equipment to Bin Laden as part of the operating agreements at these camps. Meanwhile, Bin Laden got on with the task of building up his terrorist infrastructure in Afghanistan. The U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency, DIA, later noted in a now declassified cable that, quote, Bin Laden's al-Qaeda network was able to expand under the safe sanctuary extended by Taliban following Pakistan directives, end quote. It is also noted that his camp in Afghanistan was built by Pakistani contractors funded by the ISI, which was the real host in that facility. The ISI is also believed to have tipped off Bin Laden about a series of U.S. attempts on his life in the late 90s in retaliation for the embassy bombings in East Africa. And here's the last page of this chapter, in which I have the notes about Tangled, as a lot of this stuff is, and then it ends with the roots of 9/11. It has been alleged that in 1998, the Saudis also agreed not to ask the Taliban to extradite Bin Laden to the U.S. in return for the Taliban ensuring that al-Qaeda would not target Riyadh. Prince Turki is alleged to have also promised to continue to provide financial assistance to the Taliban. However, this policy changed under U.S. pressure to secure Bin Laden's extradition, and at a meeting in June 98 between Turki and Taliban leader Mullah Omar, that's T-U-R-K-I, not the country, the latter, Omar, secretly agreed to hand Bin Laden over to the Saudis for trial for treason. But this was halted by the August 1998 U.S. cruise missile attacks on the terrorist camps in Afghanistan in retaliation for the bombing of the U.S. embassies in Africa. When Turki arrived back in Afghanistan following the attacks, Omar reneged on his promise and reportedly accused Turki of acting as an emissary of the Americans. Following this, the Saudis cut funds to the Taliban and suspended diplomatic relations. Overall, Pakistan's surge into Central Asia had produced decidedly mixed results for Britain. On the one hand, Islamabad had helped to destabilize some communist governments during and following the breakup of the Soviet Union, facilitating British access to the region's rich energy resources. To this extent, Pakistan was helpfully acting as a de facto foreign policy proxy in a region of the world where Britain had few agents or assets to promote its interests, due to the long blackout imposed by the Soviet Union. Yet, on the other hand, Pakistan had also helped consolidate the Taliban and aided the establishment of Bin Laden's camps in Afghanistan, which, especially after the 98 embassy bombings, directly threatened Western interests. Neither the Taliban nor Bin Laden's camps could have existed without Pakistani or Saudi patronage. In this light, it is clear that 9/11 was itself a product of the Pakistani surge in Central Asia, and this, in turn, had benefited from Britain's backing of Pakistan. The deep roots of 9/11 can be traced to many causes. One of them was London's long-standing view of radical Islamists as useful to securing its foreign policy goals. So there's there's the obvious blowback thing there, whereas shown over and over again, the London's trying to create this overall foreign policy goal, relying on the oil and gas resources and using the quote unquote radical Islamists in the picture. But then when things change, the winds of change move the sand, and enemy become friend become enemy. And then another thing, that pattern I've noticed is that various historical things here switch, when somebody attacks someplace, then suddenly somebody else has a reason to then attack, and it just gets all freaking tangled even more so. But with the underlying underlying strategy of positioning for the resources and people control of people and countries. So that's chapter 11. The next chapter is a covert war in Bosnia, and then from Bosnia it goes into Gaddafi and Saddam, and we know what has happened to them. So book continues to be interesting. So There may be a pause in the series. There may not. We'll see. So thanks for listening. Have a good one.